Hey, welcome to the party.
Let's have a back at the party moment. We are looking for a new way to see the world.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Back of the Party with Megan. This is my brand new podcast brought to you in partnership with my friends over at Soda Pop. And if you're listening in via audio, you can also find the video versions available on Spotify and YouTube, so you can join the party however you wish. This is episode 2, so let's head to the Back of the Party together. So if you haven't already listened to the first episode, go and listen to that, because that's going to give you information about what to expect from this podcast. But if you've already listened to the first episode, then you know that every episode is gonna be driven by this idea of a new way to see blank. So today we're going to do a new way to see or understand me. Just because you're gonna be listening to my voice for 10 episodes across the next couple of months, I figured it would be good for you guys to sort of get an introduction into who I am, get to know a little bit more about me, so you know how to situate your understanding of all these conversations that we're gonna have in the next 8 episodes. So in this episode, we're gonna do frequently asked questions and assumptions about me. So we're gonna start off with some easy, basic questions. First question is, how tall am I? So if you're tuning in via video, you might see that I look a little bit small. People always say I look very petite, but they're always surprised when I stand up. And this is the case even with very close friends who have known me for years and years. I will stand up from the table and they'll be like, oh my god, I forgot how tall you were. Or they'll see me somewhere, or they'll meet me after a long time and they'll be like, oh my god, I completely forgot how tall you were. So to answer your question, I am actually 168 centimeters. I think like when I was growing up, my dream height was at least 172, but ideally 175, because I really wanted to be a supermodel like Tyra Banks and Naomi Campbell. I vividly remember being like something like maybe 13, I must have been 13, and then googling like, how tall are Victoria's Secret models? Because I wanted to be a Victoria's Secret model so bad. And I vividly also remember going onto YouTube and then watching these like model casting videos for Victoria's Secret models, because like I loved the Victoria's Secret models. And at that point in time, like what, 10 years back, Victoria's Secret models were like all the rage. Like the end of the year Victoria's Secret show was like the event, you know, in like women's like slay age, you know, women's slay age. Right, like you have like the models with like the beautiful like lingerie, and they have like their Victoria's Secret angel wings, and like you have to earn your wings, and then you have like icons like Miranda Kerr, Barbara Palvin, Asian Queen Lil Wen. I was like, I want to do that. I was like, I want my own Victoria's Secret wings. I remember like Miranda Kerr was like my wallpaper on my little like iPhone 4 for a period of time, and I told my best friend, I was like, this picture of Miranda Kerr is so inspirational. I was like, I'm not gonna change this wallpaper until I find a better photo of Miranda Kerr. And I don't think that will ever happen. And it's like some like grainy picture of Miranda Kerr with like her angel wings or something. But I was like obsessed. So I always wanted to be like 175. I'm not. And I've made my peace with it. I think 168 is like is good enough for me. And the other question that I often get is like, because you're like 168, you're like pretty tall for a Singaporean girl. So do you like have difficulty finding men who are taller than you? The answer to that is it's a mixed bag. I think like Singaporean guys are not that tall. Like the average Singaporean guy height is like 173 cm. It's not that much taller than I am, actually. That's like 5 cm difference. To be fair, like I'm not particular about height. I've dated guys who are like shorter than I am. Short kings. Am I allowed to say that? Am I allowed to say short kings? Is that like personally offensive to our short kings out there? No, we love a short king. I've dated short kings before. So another thing about my height, my 168 cm height, is that, and it's just not obvious from my Instagram photos, I don't think, because I do look really small and petite on Instagram too, but my legs are actually like 2/3 of my body. Like, I have a really weirdly proportioned body. And I have this friend who makes fun of me for it all the time. He says I look freakishly long, that my legs are freakishly long. And he says I look like a praying mantis. And that's really stuck with me since. Like, anybody that I tell that to, like, cracks up because they think it's so funny. Because I have, like, such long limbs. If you're on video, you can see how long my limbs are. And then whenever I meet new people, especially, they always ask, like, how come you look so small in photos? And here is my working theory. You guys can let me know, like, if you guys think this is right or not. My working theory is that because I know I'm pretty tall in real life, I don't ask people to, like, take photos at angles that elongate my legs. Like, when I take photos for, like, my short friends, I was like, oh, can you take it from, like, the bottom up so, like, my legs look longer? But with me and photos, I'm just like, oh, okay, I can just take it from, like, straight on angle. Like, actually, the angle doesn't really matter. If they want to bend, it's fine. I don't really care. But then on social media, people who are shorter want to look tall. They want to look like they have long, lanky legs, right? So that's my working theory, guys. It's not scientifically proven, but I welcome anybody who wants to pick that up for their, you know, their research to do so. Just, you know, leave me a little note in the acknowledgements back at the Party Chat podcast. So next question is a fun one. This is another thing that people often get wrong, right? So this is both an assumption and FAQ, which is, what is my MBTI? And the assumption that people always make is that I am an extrovert. I guess because of the way I present myself in day-to-day as well as on social media, I totally get how it comes across as me being an extrovert. I mean, like, I'm literally hosting a podcast right now, right? I don't imagine that people would assume an introvert would host a podcast and, like, talk for an hour straight, right? But I am an introvert, and I think I have always been an introvert since I was a child. And I only really started to maybe grow out of it when I entered SOTA when I was 13. In a lot of ways, I think I was forced to grow out of it because the cohort in SOTA is very, very small. At the point of entering in year one, it's only about 200 people. So every art form is like 50 people. And in order to stand out and get a lot of like opportunities, in order to get noticed by teachers, you would need to know how to like carry yourself. You need to know how to like command attention. And the most opportunities always went to those people who were sort of like at the forefront of that, right? And so over my years in SOTA, I kind of realized like, okay, if I want to get anything done, if I want anything to come my way, then I need to start to learn to speak out, and not only speak out for opportunities, right? Speak out for myself. Like, I found that the best way to learn from classes was to also actively speak out, to ask questions, to share my thoughts. That's where you sort of get like that one-on-one interaction with your teachers. You get to sort of like put your ideas into the open where your classmates can debate with you, right? And I think that's something that I also realized really early on, which I've carried with me like all the way until now. Like, even in university, that was something that I went by, and I think was really helpful. So I'm an introvert, but learned to be an extrovert. I don't like to say that I'm an ambivert, like both introverted and extroverted. I do think that at my core, I'm an introvert. In my view, what differentiates an introvert and an extrovert is not necessarily how they outwardly act, but where they get their energy from, right? So introverts, from what I've read at least, get their energy from being alone, and being alone is when they recharge. But extroverts get their energy when they interact with others, and then they feel like, woo, I'm so like excited, I'm like recharged, right? I'm like not that way at all. I'm the kind of person who, like, if I have a full day of like work and events where I have to like meet a lot of people, mingle a lot, I will be like out of order for at least a day, if not two or three. Like, I need to hide in my room and not talk to anybody, including family. I like to just do my own thing most of the time, and I'm very, very good at being alone. So in that sense, like, I'm really quite an introvert, I would say. And I think it also lines up with this, like, back of the party vibe, right? Because, like, instead of wanting to be in the center of the party or, like, the center of attention, I prefer to, like, linger at the back. And I think another testament to this, like, introvertness is the fact that I can kind of, like, hold this podcast and talk to myself. Like, guys, I was supposed to tell you what my MBTI was like 5 minutes ago, but instead I've gone on this like 5 minute spiel about what I think is the difference between introverts and extroverts. Like, this is what goes on in my head. Like, this is what I'm thinking about when I'm alone. Like, I can fully have conversations on my own and crack myself up and like think about so many things. Okay, but now I will tell you what my MBTI is. So my MBTI is INFJ. I will say this, which is that I don't actually really believe in the MBTI. Like, they do it through asking you questions about how you think you are perceived in the world, right? Like, how would you have an accurate perception of how other people view you? Like, you only have a perception of yourself. You know what I mean? I just think that it's trying to measure something that you cannot actually accurately answer. But because I get this question a lot and because I want to talk about it on the podcast, I went to search a little bit more about what INFJ is. And INFJ is frequently known as the advocate. I'm going to read off some of the common traits and I'm going to tell you whether I relate to them or not. So the most basic, introverted, energized by time alone. Correct. The N stands for intuitive. And can I just say, why did they make it N? N is like the second letter of intuitive. Like, which is why I can never remember what N actually stands for. Okay, whatever. But N stands for intuitive, which means like focused on feelings and concepts rather than facts and details. I would say that I relate to this in the sense of like, I would much prefer, or I have had a track record of preferring to discuss big concepts and play with big ideas as opposed to getting hung up on smaller details or the current realities of things, right? And I think this has been reflected like in the things that I've talked about in the first episode, right? Because I'm not really so concerned about what's going on now as much as I'm concerned with what happens next. I still do think that details and facts are important to ground concepts in reality, but yeah. So the next is feeling, which is makes decisions based on feelings and values. I would say that that's true to the extent that my decisions often reflect my values because I think I'm very clear on what my values are. And when I'm faced with a difficult decision, I often think about, okay, which value is speaking to me right now? Or like, which values direction do I want to go into? I'm not somebody who's the best at accessing their feelings. And I think that a healthy, a productive way to look at feelings is to know that feelings are just feelings, right? Like what you do with your feelings is a completely different thing. And then how your feelings relate to your values is a completely different thing. So I don't know if I would be so inclined to like conflate or like collapse feelings and values together. The last one is judging, and it says prefers to be planned and organized rather than spontaneous and flexible. I think for the most part, or for most of my life, I have preferred to be planned and organized, but then I think I reached a point in my life where I realized that it wasn't productive to constantly try and plan everything or to organize everything. Something that's just not that straightforward, right? And then I think there are also certain scenarios where I prefer to adopt spontaneity as opposed to organization. Traveling is one of them. Especially if I'm traveling for a long period of time, I often like to carve out days where I don't plan what to do. And I know that this is very counterintuitive to what many, many people do, which is like, they love to plan the itinerary like down to a T, like this minute we're gonna leave this place and we're gonna go to this other place. But for me, sometimes I think there is value in doing some of that. Like, let's say there are certain spots you know you want to hit, okay, then you do that. But I also like to have some days where I just wander around and see where I end up, because I often feel like that's when I find like the best things, right? But I'll get into this whole traveling philosophy in a later episode where I talk about traveling and traveling solo. Other descriptions include INFJs can become discouraged by harsh realities of the present, but are typically motivated and persistent in taking positive action nonetheless. I mean, I would say that this is something that I'm on a journey towards. I'm not generally inclined to like positivity, and I do often feel like the world is super bleak, which leads to a lot of like existential questions. But at the end of the day, I do think that there is like a necessity to be compelled by hope, as discussed in the previous episode. Let's just say I'm working towards it, and this podcast is a workshop in attempt of that. This one. INFJs want a meaningful life and deep connections with other people. They don't tend to share themselves freely, but appreciate emotional intimacy with a select, committed few. This is so true. This is so, so, so true. My friends often describe me as very cagey. And this is the case even with like my bestest, closest friends. I often don't like to talk about my problems. I don't like to talk about what I'm going through. I don't like to talk about what I'm thinking about. And it's often up to like my really close friends to be like, hey, is everything okay? I'm kind of sensing like there's something that's not okay. Do you want to talk about it? Or I like to say that you always have to get me at this very specific right time, right place, like right setting. And then I'll like break and I'll tell you everything. It's really, really only with like a select few. I mean, some people say I have trust issues, but I really don't think this is a trust issue. I think it's a matter of prudence, guys. You can't be telling everybody like your innermost thoughts, I say as I host 10 episodes of a podcast. Okay, but you know, this is different, right? I'm not telling you guys like my every like inner thought instinctively, right? Like a lot of work goes into planning the podcast. So this is slightly different. Don't conflate them. But yeah, I would say that I'm a very, very private person. And I think this, in some sense, makes my job a little bit difficult sometimes, like with social media, because social media kind of demands that you share a lot of your personal life. And in order to build like a real authentic relationship with your followers, or in order to make your followers feel like they're actually connecting with a person, you do need to offer some sort of like honesty and some sort of like personal insight into your life in order for that relationship to work, this parasocial relationship to work. It's something that I've gotten better at in the last couple of years, and maybe I'll do an episode on that sometime in the future. Let me know if you guys want to hear about that. I think this podcast is a good in-between, because like I said before, my issue with other social media platforms that I feel it doesn't do justice to the expanse of thoughts that I have. So I feel like the podcast is like a happy middle ground where I get to have like an hour with you guys and actually really talk things out, right? And really be real with you in a way that's like most honest and authentic to me. Yeah. So away from these personality type questions, something else I'm commonly asked about is where I've been to school at. So I did primary school in a convent school, and then I did the equivalent of secondary school and J1 and J2 in SOTA. That's School of the Arts Singapore. It's like an art school, and you graduate with an international baccalaureate diploma. I specialized in theatre, so I didn't have to take my O's or my A's. We just did the IB program. And then after that, I went to NTU, where I studied public policy and global affairs, which is basically the equivalent of like political science. So I also get a lot of questions about university, like what I studied, how I managed my student loan, how I graduated debt-free, how to make friends in uni. I will get more into that when I do my episode on university, which will actually be the next episode. So you can tune in 2 Mondays from now for that episode, 8 p.m. But maybe let me talk a little bit more about my time in SOTA. So a lot of people ask, what ignited your passion in acting and why did I choose theatre in SOTA? So if you don't already know, I'm actually also an actress. I used to do a lot of commercial acting. I've since moved away from that. I do films, I do like TV shows on MediaCorp, MeWatch. I'm currently on a Channel 5 long form called Sunny Side Up. I play this character named Mei Yi. Started acting like when I was maybe like 4, I want to say 4. I did commercials with like DBS, Canon, some MediaCorp stuff. But I have unfortunately lost all of that. Like they got lost in the process of me like moving around, and I don't have any remnants of that. But I actually technically started acting very, very young. But I did not go down like the child actor route. My mom pulled me out of it once I hit primary school because she wanted me to focus on my education. And there were also like other circumstances around the issue of why I stopped acting. But I always had sort of like a passion for the arts, or like an inclination towards the arts and like speech and drama, things like that. Because my mom always brought me to lots of arts events, like music, theater, plays, musicals, things like that. So even while I was in primary school, like I always knew that I wanted to do like speech and drama, or like theater, things like that, right? And then one of my teachers when I was primary 6 passed me a leaflet from a SOTA, I think it was a SOTA audition leaflet. And then I told my parents that I wanted to try out for the theatre department, and they were very supportive. And that's how I got back into acting again at the age of 13. I had like no formal experience prior. I really just kind of like went into the audition and winged it. And then I went on to study 6 years of theatre in SOTA. I think in the first like 2 years or 3 years, I actually really, really hated my time there. Like I really hated theatre there because it was a very big shift having to be graded in your art. Like even now, I don't think it's a productive way to teach the arts. Just because when you are like 13, 14 years old and then you're getting graded on something that you're passionate about, it can really quickly take out the joy from the process. I mean, I don't think it's this really like the teacher's fault or anything, but because there were a lot of like playing favorites going on, it was very discouraging for me as a teen. And I almost felt like I wasn't any good in this, and I didn't know why I was doing it. And I didn't know if it was worth doing if I wasn't any good at it, right? But then when I turned 16, I got the chance to direct something very short. It was a couple of like excerpts from this play called Waiting for Godot. And I was taught by a really fantastic mentor, Matthew Lyon. And that completely renewed my love for the form. I loved being able to play with elements like time, like rhythm. I thought that being able to create something out of nothing and helping others to create something out of nothing was such a beautiful process, and it really made me fall in love with the theatre again. I also sort of like gained cognizance of the fact that getting graded for the arts is a stupid thing. Like, it's something that I have been subjected to that I really don't agree with, and that I shouldn't let these things sort of like hinder me from something that I know I love, right? And I think in order to be like a good director, you sort of need to know what it means to be an actor as well. So then that's when I started to take theatre a lot more seriously. Some of my teachers were very, very supportive. They gave me a lot of opportunities to direct and act at the same time. I guess that was sort of what really ignited my passion in acting. Like, aside from the formative experiences of getting a lot of exposure to the arts, I think the later experience in my youth of having teachers, really good mentors, nurture you and highlight your strengths, draw out your strengths, and really take the patience to do that with you, like just a random student. That was what really like gave me the second push that I needed. And I don't think I've really looked back since then. I mean, I'll be the first to say that the acting scene in Singapore is not great. Like, there just really aren't as many opportunities as you might find like somewhere else. And I don't think that's like a unique perspective that I have, right? Most people don't think we have very good actors here or very good shows here. But I think my time in SOTA has really like given me an affinity for the local art scene. And so for me, a long-term goal would probably still be to like go back into the theatre here in Singapore, to maybe direct something in Singapore, like one day in the like far, far future. I'm going to continue like researching, and I want a lot of that research to come back to the art scene here in Singapore, right? So in that sense, like, I think my passion for acting has developed so much further than just acting, like not even just to like a different side of the coin, like directing. It's just gone even further than that. Thinking about the arts most generally, or arts policies, or like the arts in relation to like politics, in relation to political theory, for example. So yeah, I mean, it's like a really deep hole that I've dug myself into. I don't think there's much of a way for me to like climb back out now that I've dug such a big hole, but it's a big hole that I'm okay with staying in, so I'll leave it at that. So speaking of jobs, besides acting, I'm also doing content creation full-time. I'm sure most of you who are listening would already know that, but if you don't know, you can find me on my socials at Meggie Chia. That's M-E-G-G-Y-C-H-I-A-A-A-A, four A's. I do lots of different kinds of content. I do like short-form content on TikTok. I do like photos on Instagram. I do vlogs on YouTube. A lot of people ask me like, will I continue to do this like content creation job full time, and how did I get started, right? So I do not intend on doing this full time, just because I think there are a lot of issues surrounding this job that people are unaware of, and I think one of that issue is like sustainability, right? I think the barriers to entry to becoming a content creator have become lower and lower over the years, but in order to make it a sustainable career and to make a branding out of yourself is a completely different thing, and that's something that I don't think everybody is suited to, and I don't know if that's something that I want to commit myself to, right? Because like earlier on in the podcast, like I explained, I'm mostly a private person. I'm not somebody who loves to share. I'm not somebody whose instinct is to share, right? I know a lot of people, like, they go through something, they're like, oh my god, I want to post this on Instagram, or oh my god, I want to like make a TikTok out of this, but that is really not like my natural reaction, right? For me, my natural reaction is to like, okay, I'm just gonna like keep it to this moment, and like the end, full stop. I'll take the photos, I'll take the videos, but I only take the photos and videos to like keep in my phone and to look back, not necessarily to like make content out of it. I mean, obviously that has changed over the years now that I get more and more into this job, but because that's not my inclination, I sometimes get the sensing of like, am I in the wrong industry? Am I in the wrong job, right? So do I plan to do this full time? I don't think so. And besides these like issues that come with doing this job full time, I think the other question is also like, will I be fulfilled doing this job? And I don't think I will be, just because there are bigger projects that I am very passionate about. Like I just mentioned, like the theater, directing, research. And I feel like I would probably find a lot more fulfillment in those areas. And those are areas that I'm going to actively pursue. But you know what? Never say never. Because if, let's say I want to be an actor in the future or a director, like nowadays, being an actor and director, like you need to do everything, right? You kind of need to have like a public profile. You need to have a branding of your own, especially if you're an actor. Being known as an actor is really opens up so many doors for you, right? That's why there's like this whole conversation about like nepotism babies. I mean, not only surrounding the resources that they get, but also the fact that they already get a leg up in like the world of being famous just by having like a famous dad or mom. Let's say I do go into acting in like a more public way in the future, or like in a bigger way in the future, then I assume like content creation is going to be part and parcel of it, or continuing to use social media in sort of the way that I am using it now is going to be part and parcel of it. So I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens like in the next 5 years, right? I think, like I said earlier, over the years, I've kind of realized that there's really no use in like planning too far ahead of time or like planning too much, because there are certain things that are just out of your reach when you are planning, right? You have no idea what's going to happen in the next year. Like, for example, 3 years ago, nobody figured that like something like COVID-19 would happen and then throw everybody's plans out of whack, right? So with that in mind, let's just, you know, keep things open. We'll see. Never say never. Okay, how did I get started as an influencer? It's sort of related to basically this answer that I just gave you, which is that I wanted to act, and I knew that the most immediate resource I had available to me was acting in Singapore, right? But acting in Singapore often entails needing some sort of public profile. Especially if you're working with MediaCorp, right? So MediaCorp commissions shows, and they want their shows to have like cast members who have a certain amount of public reach. And from a business perspective, that makes sense, right? Because let's say you hire somebody with like 1,000 followers versus somebody with 100,000 followers. The chances are there's going to be some turnover, and more turnover for the person with 100,000 followers than the person with 1,000 followers, right? Like, let's just say it's 1 in 1,000 people will go ahead and watch your show. The person with 1,000 followers, only one person's going to watch your show. But with the person who has 100,000 followers, you get like, what, 1,000 viewers from that? It is a business investment, right? And I very quickly was made aware of that reality just because I was going for castings and I would get turned away because I wouldn't have enough followers. Or directors would be very upfront of me and say like, actually, commissioner is looking for somebody with this amount of followers and up. Or in the case where the cast is like, let's say a group of 5 people, commissioner might say something like, okay, all 5 people have to add up to 100,000 followers in total. So you can have somebody with like 1,000 followers, but the rest of them need to make up like the other 99,000 followers, right? So although it's possible in a sense, it puts you at a major disadvantage, right? Because I kept running into this problem, I was like, you know what? This doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I'm going for these castings and I'm like 1 foot through the door, but I can't get all the way through because of something like that. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I just got to suck it up. I've got to like prioritize, right? Do I prioritize my privacy or do I prioritize like doing the thing that I love, which is acting? And so I sort of like waited out and I struggled for many, many years. So I first just started doing like postings on Instagram, and I'm sure many of you know, like, it's not easy to grow a following on Instagram, right? And at that point in time, this was like 2018, right? So this is like 8 years into Instagram's inception, and like, there's no like early movers advantage anymore. We're 8 years in, right? We're nearly a decade in. So it was not easy for me to build a following at all. Like, I maybe like got to like 2,000, maybe just like high thousands, but then it sort of like stagnated, right? And then around the time of like Circuit Breaker, TikTok started becoming very popular, so I hopped on there, and then I wasn't even trying to gain any sort of following there, because all this time it's like, okay, commissioners look at Instagram profiles, they don't look at TikTok, right? So I wasn't even thinking like, oh my god, I'm gonna jump on a TikTok and I'm gonna grow a following there. I just completely used it because I thought the platform was like so hilarious. I mean, just think back to Circuit Breaker, the kind of content you are watching on TikTok. It's like just really stupid, mindless content, like people using the filter that like makes your face like really wide and then like having like that weird like gargled voice. Like that, I was like, oh my god, that's hilarious. So I started doing that, and within like, I think posting the first 2 TikToks, my TikTok account really, really blew up. And I think I was lucky in the sense that not many people were posting TikToks in Singapore. A lot of people were using TikToks, but not necessarily posting, right? Because it was a bit like, is it cringe if I post TikToks? Like, I would be like, oh, should I even post this? Like, is it cringe? Like, am I trying too hard? Like, will people judge me? But I was like, okay, you know what? These are like innocent, like funny TikToks. I'm just gonna post it. Like, and if it's not cool, like, who cares? Nobody follows me on here anyway, right? But within basically the first two videos that I posted, like, I had gained overnight, like, a couple of thousand followers. And that couple of thousand followers was immediately translating into my Instagram followers. So I would say that a huge bulk of my Instagram following is actually as a result of the following that I had gotten on TikTok. So because Circuit Breaker was like 2 years ago, and that's when I really started building my following, I was like gaining maybe 100 followers a day at some point, like, which is a lot, right? So it started climbing like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. So I would say that my career here in this like social media industry only really began like a year and a half ago, when I could really actually start like making content and monetizing that content. And at the point in time, obviously, I was still in university. So that was sort of like my full-time gig, right? But all throughout uni, I was working. Working in social media and content creation afforded me a lot more flexibility than acting did. Because let's say you're filming a series. There are certain dates that are like non-negotiable, right? Like let's say they need you to film on like 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of the month. But on 1st, 2nd, 3rd, you have classes. But they can't push the shoot back for you, especially if you're not a main character. Because obviously, like, if you're just a supporting character, then we work around, like, the main character's schedules. We work around the crew schedules, things like that. We work around the commissioner's schedules, right? So acting was getting to be a difficult thing for me to do. So I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to switch lanes and I'm going to focus just on social media. And hopefully I can pay off my uni debt or I can earn enough money to pay off like a significant amount of uni debt, if not all of it, right? So I would say like in the last year and a half is when I really stepped into becoming a content creator, and how I started was through acting. And I think in this short time span of being a full-time content creator, I've learned so much just because the platform moves so quickly and people move so quickly that you're sort of like constantly forced to adapt on the job. But I will talk about this like in a later episode on social media and my thoughts on like TikTok, things like that, from the perspective of like an audience, from the perspective of like a content creator. For those of you who are content creators or who are looking to maybe explore a career in content creating. But if you have any like questions, if you have any thoughts about it, drop me a DM at Back of the Party Chat and I'll see how I can weave those things into the episode. So you know what I do for work now. Let's talk a little bit more about what I have done for work in the past and when I started working, because those are also questions that I get a lot. I think mostly because I worked all throughout my uni life and that was a really big part of like my branding on social media. And then I eventually came to pay off my school debt before I graduated. So I guess that's where the curiosity stems from, right? So I first started working when I was very, very young, like 13 years old. And it would just be kind of like small jobs. Like I would help my mum with some of like her school stuff. At the point, she was like a teacher. She was like a curriculum writer. So I would kind of do like odd jobs for her, be like a teacher's assistant, like help to print things, help to organize things, very simple things like that. But the reason why I started working so early was because my mum had always wanted to, I guess, instill the value of money in me. She was never the kind of mum who would be like, okay, here's this money. You can go out with your friends. You can go shop. Like she was never that mum, right? She was always the mum who was like, okay, you need to learn about the value of money and you're going to work so that you know when you spend money, like this is like a significant thing. Money just doesn't just like grow on trees and appear out of nowhere and then you just spend it and the end, right? Like in order to really learn the value of money, you need to know what it's like to work for that money. So I got a job helping her. Later on, I helped out at this like place, like this children's enrichment center, like performing arts center called like, I think like kids performing or something. I was just like a stagehand. I took care of the children. Like I let them backstage, things like that. I mean, it really did not pay well. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I was like severely underpaid, and I really don't know if this was like legal. I mean, if it was legal, it was certainly not ethical. But you know, it really did instill that value in me, right? Because then I realized like, okay, just to buy like a meal or just to take a cab, I needed to work like an hour, 2 hours to afford something like that, right? In my later years, when I sort of had more of an idea of what I wanted to do maybe like in uni, then I started sourcing for more like specific jobs. So I did an internship at a law firm when I was like 16 or 17, just to get the sense of like whether I would like the environment. The answer was no, I did not like the environment. I really, really hated it. I was like, woo, this is nothing like the K-dramas. This is nothing like the US dramas that I see, like, wow, so cool being in the courtroom. I mean, I went for the NUS open house at a very early age too. Like I went when I was like, I think in year four, like way ahead of my peers. And I went alone. I went at it alone. I was like walking around NUS all alone. And I was like going up to these like law students. I was like, what's it like? Tell me more. I was like, wow, this is like so cool. I'm going to be part of like NUS moot court. Oh my God. This is horrendous memories. Like 16 year old me was starstruck. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to study in this big school. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a moot court. I'm like girl boss lawyer. Right? So I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go and actually do an internship and then see if I like it, right? And this is something that my mom really encouraged because she knows that I've always been a person who is very headstrong about my values, right? So she asked me like, what if it comes down to a situation where you have to defend like somebody who you know has done wrong in court? That you can't not do it because it's part of your job, right? And I was like, I guess I'll go with, like intern at a law firm. So I interned at a law firm and I hated it. It was really boring. That's why I learned that when you graduate from law school, you're not going straight into the courts, babe. Like, you're going to the office, you're like writing emails, you're like writing claims, you're doing filing, you're like tailing the big boss around. Like, you don't get to do any of the fun stuff that you see in the K-dramas. I was like, not for the likes of me. Not for the likes of me. I'm not doing this. And then you have to work like super long hours. Like, lawyers work like, I think probably one of the longest hours besides doctors. Or like, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that. This is just my perception, okay? Don't quote me on this. But I was just like, you know what? This is not the life for me, babes. Like, I don't care how much money they make and how cool they look. Like, I'm not doing that. So I moved on from that internship. And then right after I graduated from SOTA, I stopped taking allowance from my parents. I was like, now that I'm free, I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm going to earn money. I'm going to support myself, whatever. So I did a very short stint at an ice cream parlor. And when I say short stint, I really mean one day. Like, girl, that was hard, man. Like, shout out to all the ice cream parlor people out there. Like, scooping the ice cream out is not easy. I had to like stand on a stool and I had to like use my energy to like pull out the ice cream. Like, damn, that was hard. And I was not very good at that. And I don't think the boss really wanted to hire me again anyway. But I was lucky, right? Because I knew that I had other options around me that I could explore. Because when I was in year 6, so I was 18, I was scouted for a really big UOB commercial. And this is the premise of the commercial, okay? It's a 1-week trip to Taiwan, all expenses paid. And on top of that, the payment was like in the thousands. And for an 18-year-old, I was like, what? Like, you mean you're gonna pay me to go to a different country, and I don't even have to work all 7 days because the shoot also involves like other people, other casts, and I'm getting paid so well for it, and all I have to do is act in a commercial? So that's amazing. And I went for the casting and everything, and sadly, I could not end up doing it because the filming dates clashed with my IB oral dates, which was like devastating to me. But it did let me know in the back of my head that this is something that I should go back and explore once I was free. So while I was trying out the ice cream job, I was simultaneously, or prior to that, I was already like looking for casting calls and I was already filming some commercials, right? So I was like, why am I doing this like $9 an hour, like scooping ice cream when I could be on set? And at that point in time, commercials paid so, so, so well. It could be like 1,000-ish for a day commercial. Right, especially if you do it for like a bank, a telco, like a government ad. That was how high it could go. Sometimes it even goes to like 2,000 a day, right? And sometimes the shoots are like more than a day. So I was like, you know what? I'm gonna switch lanes. I'm gonna go for a lot of castings. I'm gonna try and book commercials. And I was really, really blessed in that respect because I was landing a lot of commercials. I was doing like at least one commercial a week on average, which chalked up to a lot of money, right? So then that was what led to me continuing acting even when I went into uni. So I was still doing commercials. And then from there, I did like some films, some TV shows. And then, yeah, you guys know how the acting led to the social media. So that's kind of like a rough trajectory of like how I started working and what I did to like earn money along my youth. Oh, I also forgot to add that along the way, like in uni, I also picked up some like copywriting jobs. I think because I'm well-read and I love writing. Writing comes very naturally to me. I had like some copywriting jobs made available to me, so I just took that up as well. Yeah, but I'll get more into that next week in the episode about university. So we're moving on to the final segment of the podcast, and that is assumptions about me. So I will say that most people send in questions as opposed to assumptions, but the assumptions that I got were all basically around the same topic. So I'm going to read all three assumptions. I'm going to answer them all at one go because they all basically surround the same topic. Okay. The first assumption is that you're able to strike a work-life balance. The second assumption is that your life is smooth and always happy. Even if it's not smooth, you always have a backup plan. And the third assumption is that you always have your life planned out. And in parentheses, you seem really put together and happy all the time. I feel like this actually like could warrant a whole episode on its own. It's not currently planned for season one, but if you want it in season two, let me know on my Instagram. But I'm going to try and give you like a cursory answer to this, right? Am I able to strike a work-life balance? I would say that the answer is more or less yes. Yes, in the sense that this is a skill I've acquired over the years. I used to be very, very, very bad about this, especially when I was still schooling. Because number one, I'm somebody that when I'm in, I'm all in. I hate doing things in half measures. So when I'm in something, I give my everything into it, right? And if that means losing sleep, if that means like, you know, not getting up to like eat properly, like that is what will happen, right? And I realized by the end of my SOTA education that that was not sustainable and that I couldn't do that because it was not healthy. And I think going into uni really helped me strike a proper work-life balance, right? Because what I learned in uni was that the work never stops unless you say stop. There are always going to be readings, there are always going to be papers to write, there are always going to be classes to attend, and the workload basically never ends until you say, stop, I need to take a break and come back to it later. And then alongside uni, I was also working, right? And the difficult thing about me working and schooling was that I loved everything I was doing. Some people hate school, love working, and so they divvy up their time very naturally in that way. Or some people are only schooling, and so most of the time goes into that, and then weekend is like for leisure, right? But for me, I loved everything I was working on. I love school, I love writing papers, I love attending classes, I love doing readings, but I also loved my work. I loved acting. I love creating content for you guys, right? So I got to a point where I was like so stretched thin, and I realized, you know what? This doesn't make sense. If I'm a person who likes to do things in full measures and not half measures, I have to drop some things, because doing everything all at once means that I'm only giving like 20% to everything, and then I'm not producing like a good quality of work that I'm actually proud to get behind, right? So then I had to learn how to drop certain things and then learn how to organize my time a little bit better. And I guess that's why a lot of people have the impression from social media that my life is very, very put together, very well organized. In that sense, it is, right? I had to be very disciplined about where I put my time, how I was spending my time, and then what of myself I could give online or to people, right? Because otherwise, all this juggling was not gonna work. So do I have a backup plan? I would say that for the most part, no. Just because, like I said before, right? It's impossible to plan for everything. And when I plan for everything, I think that tends to lead to a lot of anxiousness for me, because I give myself very little margin for error or for spontaneity, and it stamps out a lot of the joy that I have in like this process of finding out what's next, which is obviously something that's really important for me. And on top of that, I think having a backup plan sort of entails this idea of like, okay, like my first option that I really wanted didn't work out for me, so I guess I'll go for like the second best option. And that's not something that I really can get behind, just because when I want something or when I want to do something, I'm like all in. I won't stop until I find a way around it and I find a way to like actually do it and fulfill like my passions. And because I'm so passionate about all these things that I'm like headed towards, for me, like there's no point in a backup plan in the sense of like, I don't want to think yet about what do I do if I fail. I just want to give my everything into what I'm working on. And if this plan doesn't work out, then I find a different way to go at it. I mean, I assume that if like I really reach like a colossal failure, I've tried like every single angle around it, then I'll go on to the next plan. But I don't think that next plan is something that I need to think about at this moment. So then moving on to sort of like the last element of this question, right? Am I happy and put together all the time? And I guess it would be easy to assume that I am, because like I've got all these things planned out, like I know my passions, I'm like driven, I'm like motivated, it's like I know what I want and I'm gonna get it. But does that really equate to like being happy and put together all the time? Like, no, it really doesn't, right? And I totally get why it comes across that way, especially because a lot of what you perceive of me is through social media, right? And although I try to be as real as possible on social media, there are just certain moments that I'm not going to share. Whether it's because it's private to me, or whether it's because it's just not edifying. It's just not something that I want to share with you, because I don't think it's going to add any value to you, right? And that's what is important to me on my platforms, that I'm value adding to you. There are definitely those moments that you don't see. And I would assume that that's the case for anybody who's using social media, not even like just content creators or like influencers per se. Like, I assume that most people are not like rushing to air their dirty laundry and all their like negative moments on social media. And I think there is something to be said for the trends on TikTok that are like, okay, here is my dirty laundry, like let's talk about it, let's laugh about it. But I think that is like a very new development, right? And I think aside from that, that is not the instinct of most people. And I think like being so driven whilst also struggling with a lot of like existential questions, like what am I allowed to hope? Like what is next? What is out there? Like how can I see things a different way? How can I create a new world? Like having to balance both things comes with a lot of tension. And that tension can sometimes be very, very uncomfortable to sit with. It's something that I've learned to sit with more and more over this year especially, but it's still something that I struggle with a lot, right? How do I make sense of feeling like, oh my God, everything is so hopeless and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do the things that I want to do, but then also feeling like, you know what, the world is so open and so full of possibility, anything can happen and maybe I will get the thing that I want. So am I happy and put together all the time? I guess the simple answer is no. And now that I'm articulating all these thoughts with you guys, like I really do think that this deserves its own episode. For us to be able to talk about what a work-life balance means and what it means to lead like a fulfilling life, especially in an age of like social media where everybody is presenting like their best moment and everybody is seems to be doing something and you just seem to be lagging behind. I mean, if you like that idea for a podcast episode, let me know on the Instagram at Back of the Party Chat. That's at BACKOFTHEPARTYCHAT. And, you know, feel free to share any of your thoughts with me about this episode on that Instagram via DMs, via comments. You can also reach me on my personal Instagram at Meggie Chia. That's at MEGGYCHIAAAA. That's 4 A's. You can reach me on all those social media platforms. Don't forget to drop me a follow at Back of the Party Chat. And share this podcast on your Instagram stories. It really helps me to get the word out, guys. It helps me to, you know, produce more episodes for you guys as well. And we've got a beautiful podcast cover, so you're going to have a beautiful Instagram story to go along with that. Share this podcast with your friends. We're available on Spotify, on Apple, on YouTube, whether you want to listen in or watch in. Yeah, whatever floats your boat, man. And thank you so much for joining me on the second episode of Back at the Party with Megan. I'll see you at the next party 2 weeks from now, Monday, 8 p.m. Till then, throw your own party. Till then, throw your own party in your room with your friends, whatever. Okay, I'll see you guys at the next party. Bye.